I guess the title of God's favorite prayer was a good one.
Yes.
We'll discuss part of the Jewish expression series, Kedusha, God's favorite prayer. One of the most fascinating questions that you could do in any home study setting is asking people, each person, what is your favorite prayer? Invariably, some people will say Shema, and we'll get to that, although you could ask whether Shema is a prayer or it's not a prayer. Shemona Esrei, favorite prayer. Ashrei, goes by the Aleph Beis, favorite prayer. We once posed this question to a group of fifth graders, and one child raised his hand. He has a favorite prayer. Favorite prayer is before he goes to sleep. The Ribono Shel Olam, Hareini Mochel Lechol Adam, I hereby forgive any person that wronged me during the course of the day. And that's his favorite prayer, because it means that he can go to sleep and wake up the next morning with a clean slate, no grudges against anybody. He's clean. He's a free bird. If you have issues from yesterday, but he forgave everybody. Hashem Kaviyachal has a favorite prayer. And we're going to start in an unusual way. First, I'd like to substantiate that it is indeed Hashem's favorite prayer, and then try to explain why, instead of what we often do, is we just study the subject, and then conclude, and by the way, this is special, we'll start off declaration from the Torah that it is Hashem's favorite prayer. It is a special experience to Hashem, Kaviyachal, and from there we'll try to understand why. We begin with quote number one. Baruchim Atem Lashem, I greet you with blessings, godly blessings, Shamayim V'yordei Merkava, those who dwell in heaven and with the chariot. Now, since we're going to get a little Kabbalistic tonight, I might as well introduce the concept of a chariot. You do know about the chariot. We use figurative language in order to understand Hashem. So, for example, we're told that there are three, and then actually a total of four supports for the heavenly chair. Now, God's not human, doesn't have a body. His legs, therefore, don't get tired, and he, therefore, doesn't need to sit down. But there's figuratively a chair. What do we mean by that? We mean that just as the human mind can comprehend that if someone sat down on a chair, all of its legs had better be supportive ones, otherwise it won't stand. So Hashem's relationship with our world is kaviyachal, like he's sitting on a chair. Is it being supported? Is his relationship with us being supported? We're told there are three and then four supports. The supports are Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the relationships of the original three fathers of the Jewish people. And the fourth leg is David. Now, originally that fourth leg, according to Kabbalah, according to the Zohar, was supposed to be our favorite uncle, facetiously, Esav. Our favorite uncle Esav was supposed to be the fourth leg, and he didn't fill his duties, and therefore that ended up being filled by David. A warrior on the one hand, on the other hand, total allegiance to Torah. When Shmuel first meets David, Shmuel says, this guy looks soul-speaking, the way a prophet can look into somebody. He says, he looks like Esav. And Hashem says, don't worry about it. He has the same qualities, the same strength as Esav. But he makes sure to ask Shilas. He talks to the Sanhedrin, the high court, before he goes to war. So there's a chariot. The chariot has support. The chariot has entourage. It's a chariot. Obviously, Hashem doesn't need, but the energies that accompany him are being described here. Hashem greets them and says, hello to you. And then he continues. Im tomru v'sagidu levanai, please inform my children, masha ani ose v'shoh shemaktishim, what I do when they say Kiddusha. Va'omrim, they say, kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. V'limdu osam, teach them they should do Kiddusha well because I'm waiting with bated breath for it. Sheyu einayim nisuim lamorom, that their eyes should be focused up high, leves tefilasam, in the direction of their prayers, meaning on Hashem. V'nosim atzmam lamayla, and they should lift themselves upwards. Where's that custom come from? To lift yourself on tippy toes when you say kadosh. V'nosim atzmam lamayla, they should lift themselves, reaching up to me. Ke'ein li hana va'olam, there is no joy to me in the world that's comparable ka'osa shah, like that moment she'eneim nisuas ve'enai ve'enai ve'eneihem, that my eyes are locked in their eyes and their eyes in my eyes. We're looking at each other. When do you go on your tippy toes? I understand when you say kadosh, 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 but it's figurative of something. When do you go on your tippy toes? When you're trying to reach something that's a little bit out of your reach. You go on your tippy toes. And you're making a declaration. I'm connecting. Holy, holy, holy. Hashem is in a different realm than we are. But I'm able to reach up to Him. I'm able to connect. When do you lock eyes with somebody? Let's start the other way. When do you avert your glance?
When you don't want to communicate.
When you're not communicating.
When you get the message to the individual.
When you are on the same page, you're looking at the person's eyes, you're locked. I'm talking to you, and you're talking to me. Hashem says, when the Jewish people say kadosh, they're reaching up high. They recognize that Hashem is out of their reach, but they recognize that it's within their ability to try to connect. And that's symbolized by lifting yourself up. And at that moment, when you get it, when you understand that Hashem, the Creator, is greater than you, but even though He's so much greater than you, it's within your power to connect with Him, then we lock eyes. Then you understand what creation is about. Because there's so many people who will either not appreciate God's grandeur, or, on the other hand, He's so great, what does He care about me? He doesn't care whether I eat that hot dog or that hot dog. What difference does it make to Him? When the person realizes Hashem is there and I can reach. I can, if I stretch just a little bit more, I can reach. That's Kedusha. Now the background for Kedusha is that there are three verses which we state as the central statements of Kedusha. You'll remember that during the week, it's a pretty quick Kedusha. On Shabbos, it gets a little bit more lengthy, but that extra, all of that extra, is what we call piyut. It's poetic. It's extra. The essence of the Kedusha is the statement, number one, kadosh, 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 which we'll visit in a moment, from the prophet Yeshaya. The statement, Baruch Kivod Hashem Em Komo, from Yechezkel. Those are the two primary verses. And then there's an addendum, and we'll see why, which is also added on as a primary verse, a third verse, Yimloch Hashem Leolam, May God reigns forever. Those two first verses, which are the primary verses of Kedusha, were experienced by the prophets that I mentioned, Yeshaya and Yechezkel, as they eavesdropped on the angels. Each of them had a vision, which we use for the Haftorah, for the prophet portion of the reading, one on Shavuos, because that's when the Jewish people experienced Hashem, one on Yisro, when we talk also about the Aseres HaDibros. These are the prophetic visions that we talk about. And as they eavesdropped what was happening by the chariot, what they heard were these verses, which are now recorded as Kedusha. The Gemara tells us something fascinating. The Gemara tells us that the Jewish people are greater than angels. How so? So the Gemara says, well, number one is easy. Our declaration is Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, Lord our God, Lord is one. How many words do we have to say before we're allowed to use Hashem's name? Shema Yisrael Hashem. Two words, and then we're allowed to say Hashem's name. So we have a pretty close relationship with Hashem. How many words do the angels have to say before they're able to say Hashem's name? Kadosh, 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 Hashem. Ah, three words they have to say before they can get into it. The Gemara says, we're greater. Now, that's worthy of a subject of its own lecture, why that's a proof. But the Gemara gives a different reason why we're greater. The Gemara says, I believe it's in Chulin, Gemara says, the angels are not allowed to say praise of Hashem until we do. We have to say first. If we say, then they can say. We have to say first. The reason is simple. Why did Hashem create the world? Basics.
For us.
For us to make the correct choices and earn reward. If he wanted to, he could pour reward upon us, but it would be meaningless because it's unearned. He wants us to make the right choice and earn reward. So, for whom did he create the world? If he created it for the ability to have free choice, did he create it for angels? Angels don't have free choice. Did he create it for animals? On a very limited level. But there's no free choice. Free choice defined as I can do what I don't want to do. And I can control myself from doing that which I want to do. On one level I want to, and on the other level I know it's wrong. Or the reverse. And I purposely follow my conscience. I purposely follow Hashem's teaching. Torah. World was created for mankind. The angels are merely a reflection of the energy that's put into the world by the human being's desire to bond with Hashem. The more we invite Hashem into the world, the more he's here, the more energy gets created. An angel is referred to as an omed, one who stands, because he can't move on his own volition. He moves if Hashem tells him to move, or if people elevate creation to the point that he gets elevated. But he himself has no free choice. He can't grow. Human beings can grow. We can be a different person than we were yesterday. The angels don't say Kedusha until they're able to reflect someone with free choice who chose to say Kedusha. And so, when the human being says Kedusha, then the angel can say Kedusha. And the human being is considered greater than the angel. The first part of Kedusha is taken, as I mentioned, from the prophecy of Yeshaya. We're in quote number 2. And the commentaries say that although this is the sixth chapter in Yeshaya, this is actually his first high-level prophecy. This is where Yeshaya's career began. And what's amazing about it is that we're given a historical context. According to many commentaries, this was the trigger to cause Yeshaya to reach the great heights, which we're about to describe, that he was able to eavesdrop on the goings-on by the chariot. Bishnas Mos HaMelech Uzziyahu. It was in the year that Uzziyahu the king died. You'll notice that in translation, I put the word died in quotes, because the commentaries say our tradition is he was not really dead. This is a famous story. Uzziyahu got saras. He was afflicted by that spiritual affliction, which is sometimes mistaken with the word leprosy, but it's a spiritual affliction called saras. We know it. We always talk about it. It afflicts someone who speaks Lashon Hara. But I'll give you the story, and you'll see how the context here is very important. Question.
A little off topic. Is leprosy real? Bible talks about leprosy.
Yes, there was a spiritual affliction. This is very clear. I didn't give you all the quotes because
I'm not trying to debate
we it. Run out of space. There were spiritual afflictions which existed, and this was recorded as having happened to King Uzziyahu, and he was banished from his position, and his son took over.
But is leprosy as we perceive it?
No, it's not the leprosy that we're familiar with that's contagious. It's actually a disservice when translators translate it as leprosy. I mention it because sometimes people grew up in Hebrew school, it just strikes a responsive chord. That thing that sometimes was translated as leprosy, that's what I'm talking about. It's not leprosy. Correct translation, and I believe Art School does this, they call it saras. T-Z, however they write it in English, but they do not translate things that are not, that don't have English translations. It was a spiritual affliction. We do not have that today. It was taken away from us in approximately the same time period as normative prophecy and everything else like that. We don't have that.
The died means he has the spiritual affliction?
Yes. I'll give you the story and you'll understand. I just gave you just the quotes. You should remember, died is not what we call dead. He was, for all intents and purposes, he lived a dead life. He was king and now he hung out privately on his own. He was banished. What happened? Uzziyahu was a righteous king. However, he drifted, and he did not remain with his closeness and affiliation to Torah study. And therefore, one day he got this brilliant idea that he, as a king, should serve God in the Beis HaMikdash. And he was going to bring Ketores, the incense. This is recorded in the second book of Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles. This is recorded that he went in and he decided he's going to bring Ketores. And the Kohanim gathered against him and pleaded with him, don't do it. And it's gorgeous actually in the Navi. I just ran out of space on the handout, so it got pushed away to discussion rather than text. But the text there in Divrei Hayamim describes how he went in, and as he walked in and tried to bring the Ketores, they looked at his forehead and it burst out in Tsaras. He himself realized what idiocy he had just done. He took, as the Talmud describes, a career where he had everything. He was king. But there was one thing he didn't have. And he ended up, because the one thing he wanted to bring Ketores in the Beis HaMikdash and be like one of the priests, one of the Kohanim, and because he reached for the one thing he didn't have, he ended up getting nothing. He ended up losing it all, and he lost his kingdom. Similar to Korach, also, he has everything. He's missing one thing. He wasn't chosen to be the Kohen Gadol. Similar to Haman. Everyone's bowing to him except for one man called Mordechai. And he goes after the one thing he doesn't have and ends up losing everything. Ends up getting killed in the process. Uzziah did the same thing. And he was struck in the act in such a formidable way that it made a tremendous impact on people. According to Rav Hirsch, that impact made an enormous impression on Yeshayah. Because until then, Yeshayah thought they were already going downhill in how much presence Hashem was in the Beis HaMikdash. It was moving towards the destruction, although he wasn't yet told to say prophecy on destruction. But as a prophet, he sensed that it wasn't as great as it used to be. And he did not appreciate that in his generation it would be possible to connect with Hashem on the highest level possible for humans and to eavesdrop on the chariot. But when he saw the king walk in to the Beis HaMikdash and be struck instantly, in his mind he was open to the revelation. He suddenly, he was on that great level either way, but now he was open to it. And that's a rule in spirituality. You can only have blessing if you're open to it. There's only so much that Hashem clobbers you over the head. You have to be open to success. I remember at a Rebbe in Yeshiva used to say, guys, I know some of you in my audience are going to become millionaires. And I wish you well. I have no trouble with the first million that you get. You don't have to share it with me. But your second million, I get a cut. I was your high school Rebbe. I get a cut. Now, what he accomplished, whether he meant it or not, is he opened us up. Now it's possible. It is possible. Rebbe said it's possible to be a millionaire. Even to do it twice. Yeshayah was opened up that Hashem's presence is in the Beis HaMikdash. We're not just going through the motions and we're doing the mitzvahs of the Torah, but Hashem is watching from afar. Hashem's right here, and he was offended. He was offended, and everybody saw he was offended. That means he's right here. That means I can connect. And Yeshayah, therefore, was open. Vo'ere, and I saw es Hashem, God Himself. He perceived, whatever that means, the presence of Hashem in a prophetic vision. Yoshev al kisei ram v'nisa, sitting on the high, uplifted throne. V'shulav, and the bottom of that throne, the bottom of it, maleim es ha'hechol, filled the hechol. So that Hashem still has a connection with the Beis HaMikdash, but it's not as direct a connection as you would expect. You would expect Him, like in the time of Moshe, there was a cloud of glory that just ensconced the Mishkan. Over here, that's not what's happening. It's connected to the Beis HaMikdash, but it's the very bottom of the throne. He was able to perceive connecting, but for the most part, it's soaring. It's already almost preparing for the exile which Yeshayah was sensing. But it's still connected. And because it's still connected, Yeshayah has the confidence to move forward in his meditative experience. And he's able to achieve this revelation. Seraphim omdim mima'alo. Seraphim, some sort of angel, some heavenly energy, are above him. Shesh kenafayim le'echod. Each one of these angels had six wings. B'shtayim yechasafanav, with two they covered their face. B'shtayim yechasaraglav, with two of them they covered their feet. U'b'shtayim ya'ofef, and with two of them they flew. And this is the expression when people make angels, they make them with wings, because how else do they get around? So in a prophetic vision, Yeshayah looking at these creations with human eyes, he perceived it as wings. They have wings, they don't have wings, angels don't have bodies. They're not birds. But in his figurative language of a prophet trying to express in human terms what he saw, he perceived it as wings covering the body. V'kara zel ze v'omar, and I heard them saying one to the other, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Hashem is holy. Three times they said it. Hashem Tzivakos, Hashem is the master of all forces. Melocha la'aretz kevodo, his honor fills the entire world. That's what Yeshaya heard, and that's therefore what he recorded in his prophecy and what ends up in our Siddur. Now, I want to make a stunning observation. There's a Siddur which is complete with commentaries. It's a two-volume work that is way thick in each volume. It's the kind of thing that if you want your handy-dandy Shabbos songs, you know, this is the kind of volume you would bring to the table, right? Okay? He has commentaries on everything. He has a commentary there on Kedusha, and he writes, there are people who have the custom to recite Kedusha starting from the word Vikara, meaning Vikara Zel Zev Omar. They call one to the other and they say Kadosh. He writes that that's wrong. He says the reason that they do that is because they don't want to say half a verse from Torah. And starting from the word Kadosh would be starting from the middle of the verse. So he wants you to start, this custom wants you to start from the beginning of the verse. And they call one to the other and they say Kadosh. And he says, that's wrong. And if you do that, you have never said Kedusha properly. Because what they're doing in that custom is they are recounting the words of the verse that the angels say Kedusha. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to say that the angels call one to the other and say Kadosh. What are we trying to do? We're trying to say Kedusha ourselves. He says, of course you're supposed to start from the word Kadosh. We're taking information from the way the angels say Kedusha as to what the text of our Kedusha should be. But we are absolutely not saying how beautiful that the angels say Kedusha. And that's what we're doing. We're saying Kedusha. And he says, by all means, you should start in the middle of the pasuk with the word Kadosh. And that's what you're saying. You're calling out the same Kedusha that the angels call out. You're not calling it out that the angels call the following out. You're calling it out yourself. Yeah. That's what the Talmud says. Very good. Very good. So you're asking a critical question in sequence. How could it be that no one knew the words Kadosh among humanity, and Yeshaya has this great revelation, and he experiences the words Kadosh, and now he comes back to humanity and tells us the word Kadosh, and the Talmud says, the angels cannot say Kadosh until we do. So then, how did the sequence start? Who said Kadosh first that enabled, okay? the answer is really very simple, but you got to put on your thinking cap. It's not necessary for the Jewish people to say the exact words of Kadosh in order to generate the angels to say that same concept. The Jewish people do have to express through their lives the concepts of Kadosh, and then the angels in their wisdom can formulate it into words. Then Yeshaya eavesdrops as to what the verbal formula has to be. But the angels would not praise Hashem with that clarity until the Jewish people through their actions were praising in that clarity. There have to be some people in the world that have reached the level of Kadosh, even if they don't know those words. Then the angels' verbal expression can reveal to us the proper formulation in verbal terms. But some people have to be making a Kiddush Hashem in order that the angels should go ahead and say Kadosh. And then Yeshaya can hear the words and tell us the verbal formula. Question. There had to have been a Kiddush Hashem that caused it. Well, the downfall of the Jewish king doesn't mean the Jewish people is an isolated incident. He went and tried to be a priest. There are tens of Kohanim that objected. They wanted to lynch him. I guess they weren't quite sure if they're allowed to lynch him. So they just verbally told him, you're not allowed to do that. And they just kept screaming at him, you're not allowed to do that. They pleaded with him not to do it. It's, if you want to look it up, it's Divrei HaYamim Beis, it's like chapter 25 or 26, Chafei Chafav, around there. You look it up. It's fascinating reading, but it just, it was too much for my handout constraints. Okay. The second verse of Kedusha is from Yechezkel. Now we just need to appreciate the time frame, especially this week is Tisha B'Av, to appreciate the time frame of the prophets towards the end of the first temple. The three great prophets are Yeshaya, that's the one we just talked about with the word Kadosh. There was a second prophet, Jeremiah, and a third great prophet, well-known prophet, Yechezkel, in English, Ezekiel. Yeshaya lives during a time when theoretically the destruction of the temple can still be averted. He's warning them, but if they would have heeded his warning, they could have turned it around. He's still distant from the destruction. Yirmiyah is in the generation of destruction. He lived through the destruction. And Yechezkel is the prophet, as we'll see in a few moments, who transitions them to the exile. Yechezkel is the second prophet of Kedusha. He also had a great vision, but he describes it in much more detail. You'll notice in quote number 2 how much preparation Yeshaya describes barely 2 verses before he gets to his revelation of Kadosh. Barely 2 verses. And as we'll see in a second, Yeshaya was on an enormous great prophecy level. The way Rav Hirsch understands it, he could have attained this level. He just didn't realize it was attainable. But this was normal for him. Yechezkel is on a different level. Yechezkel is already the exile, and for him, this entire experience was stunning. And he describes it in minute detail. This angel, that angel, what they did, how it looked, everything was new. Everything was necessary to be described. And Yechezkel describes it with enormous detail. At first glance, you would get the impression that Yechezkel's greater, because he has a much greater revelation, many verses. Talmud says, quote number 3, Kol she'ra'a Yechezkel ra'a Yeshaya. Everything that Yechezkel saw, Yeshaya also saw, even though Yeshaya did it in 3 verses or less. L'ma Yecheskel Dome, what's Yecheskel compared to? L'ben Kfar, to a person from the suburbs, you know, a farmer boy, Sharoas HaMelech, that he sees the king. So to him, to see the band that preceded the king was also an experience. And then he saw the honor guard, everybody with his brass button, and he's describing everything. And what do you compare Yeshaya to? Leben Krach, to the city dweller, Sharoas HaMelech, that saw the king. So he goes to bands and he sees them and he knows the protocol and he sees the entourage. Today he saw the king. So he'll tell you, today I saw the king. But all the other stuff, it's not that he's on a lesser level of revelation, it's just that this is normal. He knows it. And therefore he didn't consider it something necessary to retell. We're going to see another reason, difference Yecheskel and Yeshaya, but for starters, this is the difference between Yecheskel and Yeshaya. Let's turn over and we'll see the revelation of Yecheskel. Again, if you want to see the entire thing, you got to look at the rest of the chapter. I only give you the final statement of Yecheskel, which is used in Kedusha. Quote number 4, V'leich, go, bo el hagola, come to the exile. Very interesting wording, by the way. We'll try to come back to it. Go, come to the exile. Hashem's talking. Is Hashem there or is Hashem here? Go, come to the exile. El b'nei amecha, to the people of your nation. V'dibarta aleim, and tell them. V'amarta aleim, the following. Ko omar Hashem Elokim. So says Hashem. And the next statement is, Vatisa'eni ruach, and a wind lifted me, Vo'eshma acharai kol ra'ash gadol, and I heard behind me a great noise, Boruch kivod Hashem mimikomo, blessed is the honor of Hashem from his place. And that's the second statement, second critical statement that we have in Kedusha, Baruch Kivot Hashem Mem Komo.
Who's speaking?
Yecheskel. Lifted me. Now, it's not common for me to quote from Zohar, but you can't appreciate Yecheskel without this passage of Zohar. Quote number 5. Is l'she'ela. We should ask the following question. Yecheskel nevi'a mehem nahave. If Yecheskel is a trustworthy prophet, amai goli kol ma dechama. Why did he reveal everything that he saw?
Why not?
So the Zohar, I didn't give you the entire text, but he asks, if someone was invited into a private audience with the king, would he come out and tell the news reporters everything? Now, I know, for us, we're not sure, because I don't know. But the Zohar takes it as a granted that that's disrespectful. Where do you come to reveal everything that you see in the private chambers? You were granted an audience, you saw it, you don't reveal everything. That's private. That's not for everybody. Maybe that's a lesson for us. We live in a very open society. If someone went in to see a king today, there's no question he would have his DVD recorder going from behind his shirt. There's no question. And then he would play it, and he would probably, you know, find out that the king is in, or God is in violation of human rights and animal rights, and, you know, it would be on YouTube. Maybe the Zohar is telling us something as an aside, that if you're invited to the private king's chamber, you're not supposed to DVD it. Maybe he's telling us something. Anyway, question.
But isn't he was given this vision because God wanted him to...
Patience. Yes. Well, we don't know. Not every prophecy that someone experiences is meant to be repeated. You'll see, the Zohar is very, very instructive. Elevada Yecheskel Nevi'a Mehemna. No, of course. Yecheskel is a trustworthy prophet. V'choma adechoma be'emnusa ihu. Everything that he saw, he revealed with trustworthiness. V'v'rishusa dekutcha b'richu gali, and he had permission to do so. You'll notice, what's the Zohar worried about? That Yecheskel's not trustworthy. In other words, what? In other words, maybe he made it up. Why? Because if he truly was on that level, and he truly had reverence of Hashem, does it make sense to you that he would reveal it? You're in a catch-22 here. If he really is on that level, he would have such reverence of Hashem, he would tell you, let's say, Baruch Kvod Hashem in Komo, because you need it for your Kedusha. But he wouldn't give you all the details. And there are a lot of details. So is he trustworthy and he's saying the truth of what he really saw? Or he's like an amateur prophet who wants fame? Yeah.
Well, I do remember learning about prophets, and if it's a prophet, recognized prophet, we don't question whether trustworthy or not.
Fine, but there's something odd here. I don't know that the Zohar is looking many generations later to disqualify Yecheskel. The Zohar is like thinking aloud. Like, let's sort this out. What was Yecheskel doing? Well, one option is he's not trustworthy to begin with. I mean, something. I don't mean really, he's not, but like, you're thinking like, that's not the type of thing that someone with allegiance to Hashem would normally do. To tell everybody what slippers the king was wearing. It's something... Huh? Omer Reb Shimon taught, there was a problem here in Yecheskel's time. Man derogel l'mispel tzaira, a person who's accustomed to struggling with pain. Af agav de'osi l'fum shaita tzaira, even if he has pain. Sovil, he deals with it. V'lo chayish, it doesn't bother him so much. Of a man the low rogil bitzar, but a person who is not accustomed to pain, have a koyomi b'safnukin v'idunin. He's busy with delicacies and being pampered. The islay tzayra, and now he has pain. Do iu tzayra shalim. This is the ultimate pain. V'aldoitz derech lemitkin. For such a thing, you have to cry. The Zohar is referring to the Jewish people going into exile in Yecheskel's time from the first Beis HaMikdash. The Jewish commonwealth was wealthy. They were pampered. They were at the top of the world. They were laughing at the prophet. You say it's going to be destroyed? Everything's great. A prophet of doom. When they went into Mitzrayim, to Egypt, so that exile wasn't so bad. Because anyway, they were nomads. So they were nomads here, they went there, you know, they're slaves. But when you take someone who's an aristocrat and make him a slave, as a nation, everybody from town and everybody from the next town, walking in chains, that's what we talk about, Tisha B'Av. So Yecheskel was the rabbinic leader of the generation. He had his hands full. This is a depressed time. At that moment when Hashem appreciated the pain that's going on here, Hashem calls to all his heavenly hosts, all the heavenly angels, the energies, whatever he's got there, his entourage, and told them, what are you still doing here in Jerusalem? My beloved children are on the river of Babylon. And you're still here. Kumu, get up. Go quickly to Babel, and I'm going with you. So they harnessed the chariots, the 18 wheelers. Everything's moving. And they're transferring court to Bavel to be with the Jewish people. Tadnachtu leBavel, as they came to Bavel, is Patchu Shemaya, Hashem opened the heavens, meaning he allowed Yechezkel a revelation. V'shores ruach nevuah kadisha Yechezkel, and he was granted prophecy. V'chomo koma dechamo, and he saw everything. He saw everything being transferred from Yerushalayim to Bavel to be with the Jews in exile. V'amar lo liYisrael, and he told it to the Jews. Lo hem nuhu, they didn't believe him. Yechezkel, you're trying to comfort us like a hole in the head. God threw us out. God hates us. We don't understand this exile. He threw us out forever. That's the emotional feeling. And everything in the prophets is to emphasize Hashem's angry with you. He slapped you across the face, but he's still your father, and he's still taking you back. The prophecy for the first cycle was a 70-year exile. The prophecy for our exile is that we don't know the length of the exile, but we do have a promise that Mashiach will eventually come to redeem us. So we're waiting. But the concept of going back is critical, not only in Jewish intellect, but in Jewish emotion. And Yechezkel was trying to convey that to the people. They didn't believe him. They couldn't absorb what he was saying. Ad-Itzderich Legalo, he had to reveal to them, Kol Ma'adachamo, everything that he saw. Vo'erekach, I saw like this. Vo'erekach, and I saw like this. How did that help? Because there were Jews among the people who had the tradition from Yeshaya and others what the chariot looks like. And when Yechezkel started describing the right thing, they knew he really saw it. And they knew that what he was saying, there was a transfer to be in exile, was the truth. Kevan dechamu Yisrael, when the Jewish people perceived that he was saying the truth, chadu, they rejoiced. Imagine, in shackles, but the spirit of the Jew is able to rejoice. V'katshmo milin mebila di Yechezkel, once they heard his words, lo chayshu agaluson, they were not troubled by the exile, because they knew that they're still in Hashem's domain. Hashem here, Hashem there, and Hashem will take them back. The ability of the Jewish spirit to transcend circumstance. Question?
Yes.
Okay, question.
How do details actually mean someone to believe?
They knew the codes. We do this all the time. If someone claims to be proficient in a certain area, we ask him things that only someone who's truly proficient in that area could know. And if he answers in a way that he's not a charlatan, he's not just a preacher trying to make people feel good. Oh, so what color were the angels that you saw? How did they appear? How many were there? You start shooting questions, and I saw like this, and I saw like this, and I saw like this. And the sages said, this guy's for real. He knows what he's talking about. This wasn't just, he's trying to make us feel good, and he saw some low-level revelation, and he's trying to make a whole thing out of it. He saw. And that was granted to Yechezkel because it was necessary for the generation. This Zohar is a second explanation as to why Yechezkel describes everything in detail. We saw in quote number 3, the Talmud's perception was that Yechezkel was a suburban boy, so to speak. You'll forgive me for the imagery. But he came into town and, wow, they have street signs here. Compared to Yeshaya. But the Zohar says, no. Yeshaya had nothing to prove to anyone. He just needed to say what needed to be said. Yechezkel was on the defendant's stand. They were questioning. And the whole message wasn't to get the words of Kedusha, Baruch Kevod Hashem in Komo. The purpose of the revelation was, again, not to tell us what the angels do. The purpose of the revelation was to say that Hashem is still with you, even in exile. And if the Jewish people wouldn't believe that message, even if they took Baruch Kibod Hashem Im Komo and incorporated in the Kedusha, the prophecy didn't fulfill its purpose. The purpose had to be served by making it clear that Yechezkel not only heard what happened in heaven, but that he perceived a transfer of the chariot from Yerushalayim into the exile. Yeah. That is in the prophecy of Yirmiyah. After 70 years, Hashem will remember you and redeem you. 70 years from the destruction. Yechezkel doesn't have to. That was said by Yirmiyah.
So what would exactly Yechezkel prophesy?
I think what you'll find is that many prophets, when we talk, for example, of the Messianic era, there are many psukim verses that talk about the third Beis Hamikdash and that type of stuff. You have to repeat it many, many times.
Right,
because the people that are listening to you are human. And just because one prophet said it in one part of the country, a different prophet, I mean, they have to keep doing this. So even though, yes, to a certain extent, Yechezkel's message is the same, but it's not the same, it's different nuances. But even if it was the same, it needs to be repeated as they're experiencing the pain, because it's painful, and people often let their emotions rule their perceptions.
So his prophecy actually proved itself in his lifetime, or it's not?
Did Yechezkel live to see the redemption? I don't believe so. I don't think so. Okay. Question.
What I'm not sure is I don't understand why there is this going and arriving with Hashem.
Oh, good. Good.
Why does he have to arrive when we perceive him as everywhere?
Oh, so, okay, so two things. Two things I want to comment about Hashem's presence. One thing is, there is a concept called Shechina, Hashem's dominant location. Even though Hashem is everywhere, and it's really more than that, it's not just that He's everywhere, it's that the entire world was created inside Hashem, so to speak. Hashem is more than everywhere of what we perceive. Hashem was there, and He's the one who decided to create the physical world. But nevertheless, there's a dominant presence. We talk about Hashem's presence being in a shul, in a yeshiva, in a Jewish home, in Yerushalayim, at the Beis HaMikdash, by the Kotel. There's a dominant presence, a place where it's easier to connect. So that dominant presence, what we refer to as Shekhinah, that dominant presence was transferring from one location to the other to be. Obviously, Hashem was everywhere, and someone can pray to Hashem anywhere, and Hashem knows what you do everywhere, but the dominant presence, where is Hashem holding court? That was transferring.
Will they move back to Jerusalem?
Of course. Now, another comment here, v'leich and go, come to the exile. In other words, Hashem was already transferring to the exile, and He's telling Yechezkel, He comes in a revelation, go there, because I'm already there. Go there, come, or I'm going with you, come with me. But Hashem clearly is doing the same thing that He's asking of Yechezkel. The final verse, which is really an addendum, it's not from the angels, and that's quote number 6. We take it from Tehillim. Yimloch Hashem liolam, Elokayach Tzion ledor dor aleluka, Hashem shall reign forever, the God of Tzion from generation to generation, haleluka. And that's a gorgeous verse of the Jewish people ourselves affirming that Hashem will once again inhabit Yerushalayim with His Shechina. Right now He's in exile with us. But Hashem is the King of Tzion. Hashem is Yerushalayim. One day the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt. And we're affirming that as our own personal addition to Kedusha. But the first two, the Kadosh is from Yeshaya, the Baruch is from Yechezkel, and the final one we take as a Jewish expression from the words of David in Tehillim. One second. I just want to revisit quote number 1. We said, blessed are you heavenly forces, let the Jewish people know that this is my favorite prayer. There is nothing more joyous to me than the Jewish people lifting themselves up, putting themselves up in their focus, lifting themselves a little bit out of their own reach, and saying Kadosh. Why is that so powerful? Why does Hashem love that so much? I believe the answer is number one, because that was the purpose of creation, that humanity should reach out a little bit beyond where they're up to and try to grow, connect with Hashem. We said the angels can't do anything until humanity utilizes free choice correctly. I think there's another beautiful message here that Uzziyahu wanted to connect with Hashem. He only wanted to be the high priest. He wanted to be a priest. He wanted to bring the Ketores. And Yeshaya's revelation is every single Jew, every single day of his life, has the ability to say Kadosh. And that connecting with Hashem has nothing to do with the exact role that you were assigned. The street cleaner can say Kadosh and connect with Hashem, and the king can be so badly perceived in his own eyes that he ends up getting tzaras because he misplaces his spiritual mission.
Are we maintaining this connection after we finish davening? We lifted ourselves up and we're close after we finish davening?
That's up to you. The Gemara in Bracha says that Hasidim Arishonim, the original saintly people, took an hour to get into davening, it took them an hour to daven, and it took them an hour to land afterwards. That's how much they had soared before they can return to earthly pursuits.
Shouldn't try to stay at the higher.
You have to see what works for you. Ultimately, the Jew's job is to reach great heights, but also to live a life as the human being that he was created for, as long as he is still a human being, and make a Kiddush Hashem through his life, whichever mitzvah he's busy doing at that time, to do it correctly. And I think the final reason that this brings Hashem's joy is because the words Kadosh and the words Baruch were all revelations of Hashem's continuing relationship with the Jewish people, even if there's a galus, even if there's an exile. Hashem says, I'm still maintaining my connection with you. And that's the verse that we add on, that Hashem remains as the king of Tzion, and we look forward to his rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash and experiencing that relationship in an open way.